You're getting settled. Why don't you open up your Bibles to Genesis chapter 14, please? Genesis chapter 14. I invite you, if you didn't bring your own copy, grab a copy of the Bible. There should be a plenty in the seats in front of you. I want everybody to be able to see this with your own two eyes. Make sure the preacher doesn't make stuff up, okay? Genesis chapter 14. It's on page 10. Page 10, keeping it simple. So last week, we talked about failure. And the conclusion that I think we came to, or at least that I came to, hopefully you came along with me for the ride, is that it's actually possible, and not always not just possible, but it's actually almost easy to learn a lot from failure. See, when things don't go our way, or even worse, if we totally drop the ball on something, then what we find out about ourselves in that moment is who we really are and what we really believe. Failure has a way of kind of taking all your excuses and all of the stuff that you claim but you don't really believe and boiling all that down, and all that's left is what you really are and what you really believe. When that pressure rises and you feel squeezed, when you face adversity or pressure and failure, that's when you find out what you are really made of. If you think about it, in times of failure, you learn about your weaknesses, don't you? Most of the time, we like to think we don't have any of those, or we like to pretend that they don't really affect us. In times of failure, though, we learn about our weaknesses. We actually can identify the ways that we need to grow up. We actually are forced in many ways by failure to confront our character flaws, which sometimes are fairly significant. When we face failure, sometimes we actually learn how to ask for help. But I think most importantly, the reason that failure can be our friend is because it's in the middle of failure that you learn things about God you would never learn when things are going well. There are things about God's character and the way God interacts with us that you will never learn when everything is going great. When you drop the ball, when you mess up, when you fail, that's when you see things about God you would have never seen otherwise. And we saw that Abram learned that lesson when it was our study last week. Abram went down to Egypt. He lied and deceived. He threw his wife under the bus. He was willing to turn his back on all the promises God had given him, all to save his own miserable neck, right? His character flaws and his lack of faith became incredibly obvious. But the flip side of that, the good news about the failure Abram experienced, is that Abram got to learn some things about God that he would have never learned otherwise. Even though God will humble our pride, God always keeps his promises. Abram learned that in our study last week. In other words, God doesn't wait to be good to us until after we've been good to him. He just does what he said he was going to do. He's a God who extends grace to the undeserving. You see, you wouldn't know that about God if failure didn't exist. If you never had those moments when you fell on your face, you'd never know God was a God of grace. You'd never know that God is the God of second chances. Failure actually helps you to realize these things about God that are true. And the good news about Abram is that Abram actually takes advantage of that second chance God's offer him. And when we look in our story, if you were to read chapter 13, what you see is that Abram has now gone back to where he was before. He went down to Egypt on a really ill-advised 3-hour tour, right? And he came back to the place God had promised him, and now he's wandering around, and he's back to living a life of faith, which for Abram means wandering around from place to place, not sure where I belong, not sure where my next meal is coming from, not sure where my next stopping point is going to be, and just trusting God's going to take care of me and my family. So he's back to where he was at the beginning, but the difference is he's actually better off now because he actually knows God better now than he did before his failure. Now, that was last week. What we're going to learn in our passage today is that God is not done teaching Abram lessons. There are really important lessons you can learn from failure. You ought not run away from failure. You ought not try to avoid it at all costs. Failure can become a friend. But there's other things God wants to teach as well. There's other ways God wants to push us forward. Have you noticed God likes to do that? We sometimes get very comfortable once we reach a certain level of understanding, a certain level of maturity. Like I'd like to stay there. I'm like, I like the view from up here. This is nice. And God's like, hey, you look up into the clouds, there's more mountain to climb. God is always nudging us forward towards that next step, that next lesson we need to learn. God never gets complacent. That's how he rolls. That's just who he is. That's what his passion is. So what is he going to learn this time around, Abram? What are you going to learn? Okay, Abram, I want you not just to learn from failure, but I want you to learn from success. From success. So what I want to do today is I want to dive into the story itself. We'll take a look at the story, and then from it, we're going to find some lessons of success that we need to learn, that Abram needed to learn, that we need to process as well when things are going well. So you're in Genesis 14, right? Well, if you know anything about a good story, you know that every good story needs a little bit of tension, right? Otherwise, it's just a Hallmark movie and nobody likes those. I'm just joking. Some of you probably do. You need tension. And a lot of times in a good story, you start with tension and that leads to conflict. And that conflict usually turns into a full-blown crisis. Well, that's what's going to happen in this story. Now, this is where I earn the money that you guys sacrificially give to me. When you see some of the names I'm going to have to read in the next 2 minutes, you're going to be super impressed. And yes, I am making up half of them. Here we go. Verse 1. In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Kedor Laomer, how do you like that one, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goim, these kings made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, just in case you were wondering which Bela that was. And all of these joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Kedor Laomer, but in the 13th year they rebelled. So in the 14th year, Kedor Laomer did what you would expect him to do, and the kings who were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth, Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Shava, Kiriathaim, and the Horites in their hill country of Seir, as far as El Paran, on the border of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En Mishpat, that is Kadesh, defeated all the country of the Amalekites, also the Amorites who were dwelling in Hazazon Tamar. So the story opens with a conflict, and you probably lost it in the midst of all the weird names, and I don't blame you. But there's a conflict that is getting large in this local area. Now, this isn't like on the level of like a World War I or a World War II, because these kings are kings not of an entire country, but kings of a city and the surrounding areas. But kings of city-states would ally together whenever they needed to go beat up on somebody else and take what they wanted. And so you have a battle here of five kings against four. And this region is where Abram is wandering around. So it's sort of affecting his life a little bit at this point, but it's about to quickly escalate from a conflict into a crisis. Look at verse 8 with me. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out, and they joined battle in the valley of Siddim with Kedor Laomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goim, Amraphel, the king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. Now the valley of Siddim was full of bitumen pits, and as the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some fell into them, and the rest fled to the hill country. So the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. Up until this point, okay, the story is pretty boring. I won't lie to you. Okay, there's a little conflict, five kings against four, some win, some lose, blah, blah, blah. What does this have to do with me? Here's where it gets personal. Look at verse 12. they also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and they went their way. Now, friends, this may not seem like that big of a deal, but this is a full-blown crisis. This is Abram's nephew, Lot. He brought him from Ur in the beginning, and Lot had actually broken off from Abram in chapter 13 and went and allied himself with the wrong side in this particular war, the losing side, right? He was on the side of Sodom and Gomorrah because that's where he lived, and in the process of the victory of the enemies, they take him and all of his stuff, all of his family, all of his people, and they drive them away back to their home country. Now, you need to understand what's happening here. What's happening here is not just a relocation. What is happening is all the people that have been captured, all the stuff that has been captured, now is the property of Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam in the north. In other words, they are now his slaves. When you talk about what Lot and his family are about to experience, they're experiencing great suffering, slavery, eventually, ultimately, their own death. And friends, there is no Marines to call. The Marines just got beat. There's nobody to stop them. There's nobody to intervene. There's nobody to dial 911. Their lives are over. Or are they? Take a look at verse 13. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and of Aner. These were allies of Abram. Verse 14, when Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them, and he went in pursuit as far as Dan. So first you have a conflict that leads to a crisis. Lot's been taken captive. And then what Abram does is Abram takes immediate action. He doesn't hesitate. Do you notice that? He doesn't have a consultation. He doesn't bring his buddies in and say, hey, what should I do? Apparently, he knew what the right thing was to do. He knew he needed to save his nephew from the horrible fate that was awaiting him. So what does he do? He assembles his servants, he arms them, and then he leads them off on a manhunt. Like this is, if this is an Old West movie, this is the posse that's going behind the outlaws trying to rescue the guys who have been captured. He is actually chasing down a victorious army, and he has 318 guys to back him up. Now, to me, that's pretty impressive. I'm not sure I could convince 318 of you to come with me on a war like that. So the fact that Abram could is still pretty impressive, but you know what? I bet you that the five victorious armies have a couple more people than that. In fact, there may be more captives than that, let alone the army that's driving them north. But here's Abram. He's not hesitating. He's going to do whatever it takes to get him back. You may have seen Liam Neeson in the movie Taken, where his daughter is kidnapped. And Liam Neeson has a certain set of skills that makes him a nightmare for people like that. And he uses those particular set of skills that he learned working for the government, and he finds his daughter. And that's what the movie is about. He's going to do whatever it takes. He's going to do it. He's going to hunt them down. He's going to find her. He's going to rescue her. He's going to save her. That's what's happening here in this story. If there was a movie, I think Liam Neeson might play Abram in this. Now, I could say this. There's a little side lesson here about courage. There's a side lesson in this story about rejecting passivity. You know what I'm talking about? Passivity is where you sit back and wait for somebody to tell you what to do. You sit back and let other people step up. You're afraid of the consequences, so you kind of just stay back and stay silent. Abram had no problem with that. He took action. He stepped up. He was choosing to do what was right, no matter what it might cost. Now, how does this relate to our story? It's very simple. Last week, we talked about the lessons that Abram learned from failure. And in this story, he proves he learned those lessons. You remember back in Egypt? Back in Egypt, he was willing to sacrifice his wife to save his own miserable neck. But not this time, right? This time, he's choosing to proactively step out in faith to help somebody who desperately needed him. Because I want to remind you of something. As far as we know, Abram is not a soldier. As far as we know, these 318 trained men, they're not Navy SEALs. They're just guys who work with our servants of Abraham. He's leading them out. He's outnumbered, but it doesn't matter to Abram because he knows what the right thing is to do, and he just does it. Abram could have chosen to be passive. He could have just sat on his couch and done nothing. But instead, Abram took action and he put himself in harm's way to help someone who was powerless, to help someone who was in trouble. Friends, Abram has come a long way from his little trip down to Egypt. He's learned a lot. He's grown. So there's a lesson here about that. But the text doesn't linger here. It keeps moving, so I need to keep moving as well. Because notice what Abram now is about to experience in verse 14. Verse 14 says this: when Abram heard that his kinsman had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Verse 15, and he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. By the way, that's a long way north. That's up in modern-day Syria at this point, okay? Then, verse 16, he brought back all the possessions and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions and the women and the people. So, what does Abram do? He experiences success. Amazing success. Somehow he catches up to this large army with all their captives. He sneaks up on them. At nighttime, he divides his forces with some kind of a plan. He engages this army. He actually wins the battle, and he chases all the bad guys back to their home. And then, just to make sure you know this is a really big W for Abram, he rescues everybody that needed rescuing, along with all the stuff, and he safely delivers them back to their home. I mean, it's the ending of Taken all over again. I mean, it's crazy. Friends, this should not have happened. Sometimes we read the Bible and we're like, oh yeah, they won a victory. Oh yeah, that happens all the time in the Bible. People win victories. 318 guys against an army of thousands. He divides up his 318 because apparently that's too many to attack them all at once. And he wins the battle. This shouldn't have happened, but it did. And friends, I'm telling you, Abram at this point in the story is an absolute, honest to goodness hero. Think about how the captives he rescued felt about Abram in this moment. Can you imagine? Can you imagine how grateful they are? Can you imagine them singing his praises as he leads his trained men to rescue them from their enemy? As he sweeps them, Lot, in his arms? What does Lot feel in that moment? How about all the families of those captives that are left back home in Sodom and Gomorrah and other places? How do you think they feel about Abram when he comes marching in, bringing their family, who they long gave up for dead or worse? And he brings them back, and everybody's there. There's nobody unaccounted for. Even my stuff is back? How about the king of those people, the person who's in charge of them? How do you think he feels about Abram? I'm pretty sure that he says, who is this guy? I mean, I don't know who he is right now, but if I'm the king, I'm like, I'm finding out who this guy is. Take a look at verse 17. Verse 17 says this: after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. And I go, duh. Of course he does. You want to know who this guy is. He was able to do what your five armies couldn't do. He did it with 318 guys and no real plan, no real training, no real experience. And he did what we couldn't do. You better believe I want to know who this guy is. I can imagine the ticker tape parade as Abram is bringing everybody home safe. And now he's going to meet the king of Sodom. And I want to make a suggestion to you. This is Abram's opportunity for his 15 minutes of fame. This is his opportunity to become at least local celebrity. If he plays his cards right in this conversation with this king, he can turn the success he had in this battle into a really nice return for himself. If it goes well, Abram is about to be put on the map as a significant player in that entire region. It's almost like life is saying to him, hey, Abram, you've now had some success. Now it's up to you, buddy, to capitalize on that success. Now, up until that point, Abram's actions had proven that he had learned the lessons of failure, and he was courageous and bold, and he took advantage, and he stepped out in faith. But now we're going to find out if Abram is willing to learn from his success. By the way, isn't it funny how things change when you experience just a little bit of success? I mean, in some ways, doesn't life just get a lot easier? Life gets a lot better. You have some success in whatever area we're talking about, you start to get noticed a little bit more. You start to get a little bit more attention. You start to get people praise you a little bit. You start to maybe become a little bit well known around you. And then all of a sudden, you got these people, they want to hang out with you. They want to be closer to you. They give you all these incentives to let them get closer to you. People start to look up to you as this valuable person who's important. You've had a little bit of success, whether in business, in life, with your family, whatever. And people all of a sudden, man, you matter. You're important. And the perks that go along with that, those are fun. But success has another edge to it too, doesn't it? Once you've had a little bit of success, the pressure in your life escalates. Why? Because now you have to duplicate that success again. You close the big deal. You get the big bonus. Everybody loves you. Well, guess what the boss is going to expect from you next time? You close another deal. You take another step. You hit 50 home runs and lead your team to the World Series. Guess what happens next year when you hit 35 home runs and you lose in the divisional round? Everybody wants your head because the pressure has increased. And also, too, something I don't know if you've noticed this when you've had a little bit of success, people show you less and less of who they really are because now they're eager to impress you. So they put this front and they're trying to impress you with something and you wonder, am I really talking to them or are they faking this out because they want to be close to me because of my success? And then the worst of all, your head starts to swell. Hopefully not literally. But all of a sudden you start to get a little bit proud. You start to feel you are kind of a big deal. You start to treat other people like they're a little less important. See, this is the thing about success. The sharp edge to success is that success can actually set you up for a greater failure if you don't learn the lessons of success. You can probably think of a few people in your life that you know have been ruined by failure, right? We all know that one person out there who failed and their life was never the same. You know what I could point to, though? For every one of those people, there's probably five or six that their lives were ruined by the success that they had attained. When you think of the word train wreck, you generally think of somebody who used to be successful and VH1's behind the music. Where are they now? Because success brought them down. Success is really fun, but success is also incredibly dangerous because success can actually set you up for a bigger fall than if you never succeeded in the first place. Now, Abram is about to have probably the most important conversation of his life up until this point. And he needs to really be careful here. Because if he doesn't handle this conversation with this king properly, then it could ruin him just as badly as his failures in Egypt could have ruined him. Now, luckily for him and for us who want to learn from him, God steps in at exactly this moment right here and along the way teaches what I'm calling three lessons about success or lessons of success. Now let's read the passage and I'll try to get you this first one. And I got to warn you, this is a little odd. Again, we're in the Old Testament, so you should be prepared for that. Verse 17. After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet Abram at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. Now look at this. This is weird. Verse 18. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. And then in parentheses, as a side note, which is kind of an important piece of information, oh, by the way, he was priest of God Most High. And he, that's Melchizedek, this king who comes out of nowhere, who's also a priest, blessed him, that's Abram, the hero who just rescued everybody, and said, blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. Now, what in the world is going on here? Before we even get to the conversation with the king of Sodom, another king interferes and puts himself in the middle of the conversation. Now, his name, it's a winner. You're probably going to run out and name your kids and grandkids Melchizedek, right? It actually means the king of righteousness, or the king is my righteousness, depending on how you want to translate it. All we know about him are a couple of small things. He's also a king from another city called Salem. Salem is a version of the word in Hebrew for peace. The king of peace, from the town of peace. We find out later that it has a different name later on in history. Jerusalem. He's from Jerusalem. He's the king of Jerusalem. And here's the shocker. Well, the good news for the guys is that he's bearing gifts, and the gifts are food. Food and drink. Abram's come back from a battle. He's hungry. He's thirsty. He's like, look, let me take care of you, buddy. I'm going to bring some food. I'm going to bring something for you to drink. I'm going to refresh you. And then here's the real shocker. Somehow this guy who lives in Jerusalem, who apparently is not a Jew, he's not connected to any of Abram's family, he moonlights as a priest. He's a king by day, priest of God by night, or maybe it's the other way around. I don't know. But he has a double job. He's a king and a priest, and he's not just a priest of some pagan god. He's a priest of the Most High God. And here's the crazy thing. He interrupts the conversation between Abram and the king of Sodom because he has a message from God Most High to deliver to Abram before he has the conversation with the king of Sodom. And here's where we get our first lesson of success. You ready for this? Boy, I hope this makes sense. Number one, fill in your blanks and then we'll talk about it. All success comes from God. Now, that's a simple thing, but it's really hard for us humans to wrap our brains around this simple idea. But Melchizedek interrupts Abram's conversation and says, hey, Abram, I want you to learn a lesson from success. I've got a message for you, Abram, from God Most High. And that message is this. All your success, every little piece of it, comes from God. Now, you've read the story like I have. It must have been incredibly tempting for Abram, don't you think? To believe that he had achieved success because of his own efforts, right? I mean, think about it. Abram is the guy who took the risk and left home. He's the guy that chased down the bad guys. He's the guy that actually led his troops into battle and fought the battle. He's the guy who rescued everybody and brought them back. Now, if I did all that, then I should get the credit, right? Isn't that how it works? I mean, look at all my hard work. Look at the plans I put together. Look at how smart I am. Look at what a great fighter I am. Look what a great leader I am. I made this happen. That's what success wants you to think. Success whispers in your ear that you are the hero of the story, that the story is really about you. And friends, I just got to tell you, and I think Melchizedek is trying to tell Abram, that is an incredibly dangerous place to be. Melchizedek is having none of that. He says, look, buddy, your success came from God. Would you look back at verse 19 with me? Verse 19 says, and he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram by God Most High. He says, you want to know where your success came from, Abram? It came from the fact that God chose to bless you. He blessed you. And then look down here. And blessed be God Most High, who has done what? This is the part where you can like mumble back at me so I know you're awake still. Right? Who has delivered your enemies into what? Into your hand. He says, look, do you know what? You want to know where your success came from, Abram? It didn't come from you, actually. The only reason you won the battle is because God gave the enemies into your hand. God, Abram, I hate to break this to you and to your success, but God was working behind the scenes to make sure that things went your way. Sure, Abram, sure. You deserve credit for stepping out and doing the right thing. Fine. I will high-five you and reward you for that. You stepped out and did the right thing. But I got news for you, buddy. Only God can turn your hard work into victory. So in the end, when you achieve victory, guess who gets all the credit? God. Now, humans have a hard time with this, don't we? We have a really hard time learning this lesson. Why? I think it's because we become really impressed with ourselves. We're really impressed with our hard work. We're really impressed with our skills and our talents. We're really impressed with all the good things that we can say we brought to the table. And we have a really hard time letting go of credit. You know how I know this? Because if you work really hard and nobody thanks you, it bothers you. You bleed for something, you sacrifice for something, you work hard, and nobody says, good job, and how do you feel? You feel upset because part of you wants the credit. I made this happen. We have a really hard time too, by the way, don't we? Admitting how much of our success was actually outside of our control. We like to think that our actions, that the reactions to us are 100% determined by the things we do. But the reality is our success, right, has a lot to do with factors completely outside of our control. Now, Abram's descendants, hundreds of years later, struggled with the same thing. Can I show you a really interesting passage in Deuteronomy 8? It's going to be on the screen behind me here. It says this, God is speaking to Abram's kids, grandkids, descendants, right? He says, take care lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his rules and his statutes which I command you today, lest when you have eaten and are full and have built good houses and live in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and gold is multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart be lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the land, the house of slavery. He says this, beware lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may confirm his covenant that he swore to your fathers as it is to this day. Success is dangerous because success makes us forget God. And all of a sudden, we take credit for stuff that was never under our control. Think about this. Where did you get the brain you have? I mean, sure, you use it, and props to you for using your brain. Where did you get it? You were given that brain. What about your incredibly strong back? You're like, you know what? I've built a career off of being able to lift things and do things and engineering my way and hardworking, you know, sweat on my brow by the blood, sweat, and tears. I've built my life. Let me ask you this. Who gave you that strong back? Where did it come from? Did you buy it? Or was it given to you? Now, you deserve credit for developing that body. I'm not saying we have no part in this at all, but the success doesn't just come from you. And you need to remember that. It is God who gives you the power to get wealth. You deserve credit for using and developing those gifts, but the gift itself deserves, the gift giver, excuse me, deserves the ultimate credit for what you do with it. Listen, Everything you are, everything you have is a gift from God. Everything. He owns everything. Do you notice Melchizedek says that right here? He says in verse 19, blessed be Abram by God Most High. What does it say he is? Possessor of heaven and earth. In other words, you know who God Most High is? Who's blessing you? He's the guy who owns everything. He owns the air you breathe. He owns the land you're standing on. He owns the sky that you look up to. He owns it all. It belongs to him. Any success you have in life is there because God put it there. Don't forget that. Don't get cocky. You can't do anything apart from God and from the gifts that he has given you. And I'm really glad Melchizedek showed up at this moment, because Abram must have been flying high, baby. Success, success, success. And now I get to be a big shot in our area as the king comes out to welcome me. And Melchizedek says, oh, before you have this conversation, I want you to remember something, buddy. You didn't defeat these enemies. The Lord gave them into your hand. Oh, by the way, he's the possessor of heaven and earth. Credit belongs to him. There's a second lesson that I see here. A second lesson. So let's read verse 20 again, right? And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And then notice this really weird phrase. Not invented by preachers trying to get you to give more money to church, by the way. It's just there. It says this, and Abram gave him a tenth of everything. A tenth of everything. That's weird unless Abram had learned a second lesson. And here's the second lesson, that success demands a response. Success demands a response. See, I really think Abram understood lesson number one, that all success comes from God. And so when he learned lesson number one, when it really sank into him, he immediately responded by giving back to Melchizedek a tenth of everything that he had conquered. Do you notice nobody asked him to do that? God didn't say, you know what, it would be really nice, Abram. I gave you this whole victory and everything. Maybe you should think about giving some of it back. He doesn't do that. You know why? Because nobody had to. Nobody had to tell Abram what to do. He understood. I have to respond to this. God has done this amazing thing. He's given me this amazing success. I need to respond. Now, how did he respond? How did he respond? Three different ways that I see here in this text. And yes, I'm using a little bit of imagination, but work with me here. Number one, Abram responds with humility. With humility. Now, I want you to think about this. Abram gives this gift to Abram humbly. Why does he give it to Melchizedek as the representative of God Most High? He gives it because he's acknowledging God's involvement in his success by his gift. Abram doesn't say, that's mine. I fought for it. I won it. I earned it by the sweat of my brow and the blood of my soldiers. That's mine. He goes, whoa, 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 whoa. This success, all of it, 100% belongs to God. If he's given me 100%, I can give you back 10. See, success tempts us towards pride. Success tempts us to be impressed with ourselves and with our big accomplishments. And in our own eyes, we get huge. We get really important. We get entitled to special treatment. And we say things like, nobody ever gave me anything. I worked for what I have. I had to earn it. But the moment you learn lesson number one, the moment you finally let that go and say, wow, all success comes from God, all of a sudden you shrink back down to normal size. Now, I will say this, you don't disappear though. Humility isn't you disappearing and now you're just this little squashed bug under God's boot. That's not humility. But it's when you're shrunk back down to proper size and you say, you know what? I'm not that big of a deal. I'm not the reason this happened. I've been blessed by the person who is the big deal. So humility is when you shrink down to normal size and God shrinks back up expands to his normal size. And all of a sudden you realize, you are God in heaven, and I'm here on earth. I'm not a whole big deal compared to you. This is your deal. I'm here for you. I'm here for you. And humility, humility. You say things like, God could have done this for anybody. He could have given this gift to anybody. He could have given this career to anybody. He could have given my kids to anybody. He could have given this perk that I get to anybody. But he gave it to me, and I can't believe it, as a blessing. Now, have you ever been around a successful person who's also humble? That you're around them and you don't get a sense that they think that they're more important than you or that you're no big deal compared to them. Have you ever hung out with somebody like that? I hope you have. It's an amazing experience to be touched by humility. When you know somebody, if they wanted to, could puff themselves up real big and make you feel really small in comparison. But the people who have learned the lessons of success say, no, 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 no. I need to respond to God giving me success by being humble. Second thing, with gratitude. With gratitude. See, gratitude goes beyond humility because gratitude redirects attention to the one who gave you gifts. So when I'm grateful, not only am I refusing to take the credit for things, but I'm loving to point out who should get the credit. See, when I'm grateful, I praise things. When my wife gives me something I did not expect that blesses my heart, I can't say enough to her, and I can't say enough about her for all the amazing things that she's done to me. See, gratitude is public, not private. Everyone knows that I don't take credit, but I pass it along to the person who does deserve it. I think Abram expresses gratitude with this gift. Because everybody who observed him giving the gift knew that he was giving credit to God. He was grateful. So he was humble and he was grateful. That's how he responded. And one last thing, he responded with generosity. Do you know that Abram was legally entitled to 100% of what he had won back in the battle? He could have had it all. He could have kept it all. It was his, in a sense, and no one commanded him to give anything. Abram just understood something, is that if 100% of it belongs to God and God gave it to me anyway, then he must have intended for me to do something with that gift besides just take care of myself. I mean, if it's not mine in the first place, then if God tells me to give it away, I can give it away. If God gave it to me, he must have a plan for how he wants me to use it. So I don't have to grasp at all my stuff and hold it to myself greedily, afraid somebody's going to take it away from me. Because if I need more someday, guess what? The person who gave me the success in the first place can give me more success in the second place when I need it. So I don't have to be greedy and hold on to it. This is all God's deal in the first place. And I wonder if Abram is really starting to wrestle with this idea. Maybe God blessed me so that I could be a blessing to others. I really believe, friends, that successful people should be the most humble, grateful, generous people in the world. When you spend time with somebody who has learned the lessons of success, you're like, wow, they don't think they're that big of a deal. Wow, all they can do is redirect attention to God for all that God did to make this success happen. And these people, they're just generous. They give stuff away. They give praise. They give compliments. They give their money away. They give their stuff away. They share. They just do it. Why? Because they realize that all the success I had in the first place only came from God. So he must have a plan for how he wants me to use it. So this is where we pause for just 30 seconds, and I want you to think. And I want you to ask yourself the difficult question, how are you doing with this? If I took the 10 people who knew you the most, in your family, in your workplace, in your neighborhood, at your school, your 10 closest people, would I be able to hear from them that you are a person characterized by humility in your success? Or are you the kind of person who goes around tooting their own horn, reminding everybody of how really skilled you are, how knowledgeable you are, how much you have? Do you come across like you're the hero in all the stories you tell? How about this? Are you, if I ask them, would they tell me that you're the person who's always deflecting praise for your accomplishments back to God? Or are people in awe of how great they think you are? When you succeed, are you a generous person with that success? Do you pass along credit to other people? Do you pass along praise to other people? Do you pass along material blessings to other people to share with you? Or is it all about you? Lessons of success can be hard to learn. One last lesson. Stick with me, I'm gonna let you go home soon. Verse 21. Verse 21 says this, and the king of Sodom, so here we go. The king of Sodom finally gets there. God has had a chance to say, hey Abram. All success comes from me, don't forget. Oh, and by the way, you need to respond to this news that all success comes from me. And then, okay, go back, go, talk to him. The king of Sodom shows up, verse 21. He said to Abram, give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself. Isn't that magnanimous? All these captives. Now, why is that even a thought? Because in a sense, when Abram captured those captives, guess who they now legally belong to? If he wants to, under the ancient laws of the time, he could say, these are now my slaves because I conquered them from the people who took them away. And the king of Sodom is saying, tell you what, why don't you give me the people and you can keep all the loot, you can keep all the stuff, you can keep all the cash, all the disposable income, right? That sounds like a good deal. Here's the thing though. There's strings attached. Take a look at how Abram responds. Verse 22. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted my hand to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. By the way, who does he sound like he's been talking to lately? Do you think Melchizedek's message sunk in? He's quoting him word for word. He says, I raised my hand. What does that mean? I took an oath. I swore. What did I swear to the Lord, the God Most High? That I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. I will take nothing but what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me. Let Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre take their share. See, Abram knows without the king of Sodom saying it, that when he accepts that gift, there's going to be strings attached. If he accepts the reward from the king of Sodom, then he's going to end up attached to that king, and he's going to owe him loyalty going forward. Because here's the deal. This is a general principle in life. You always serve the one who rewards you. You always serve the one who rewards you. It doesn't start that way maybe in your head, but it always ends up there. Here's how that plays out. If you live for the rewards people around you can give you, then I guarantee you something, in a matter of time, you're going to do whatever you have to do to get rewarded by those people again. If you say, oh, give me love, and they give you love and you feel good about it, guess what you're going to do next time? You need love. You're going to go to them and say, what do I have to do for you to give me more love? If you say, give me approval, I need your approval, please give me approval. And they say, here, have my approval. You know what? You're going to make sure you don't do anything to screw that up. You're going to follow whatever rules they give you so that you can always keep that approval. Money, respect, praise, it's all the same. If you're desperate for it, then you'll do whatever they want you to do to keep it coming in the future. The people who reward you will end up being your boss. And God's going to get squeezed out. Why are we shocked that Jesus all the time talked about the fact that our loyalties to people on earth and to things on earth can totally mess up our loyalty to him and get in the way of that loyalty? So Abram realized something very smart. Shows me he learned the first two lessons we talked about. Abram realized it's actually better to go unrewarded than to be rewarded by the wrong person. So he actually says to the king of Sodom, no thanks. I don't need you to reward me. I don't want to owe you a thing. But this leaves Abram in a tough spot, doesn't it? He risked his life and he's got nothing to show for it. I want to show you one last piece of this. Look at verse 1 of chapter 15. See, the chapter titles and the divisions there, that was added hundreds and hundreds of years later. This, I think, is a continuation of the same story. Why? Because of the phrase at the very beginning. What does it say? After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram. I am your what? Shield. Your reward shall be very great. Lesson number 3 is this. Only God can adequately reward us. Only God can adequately reward us. I love this, that God jumps into Abram's life at that moment when he's like, I guess I don't get a reward then. And God's like, no, Abram, don't worry. I got you. I'm your shield. Your reward's going to be great. Hey, Abram, I promise you, I'm going to show up. I'm going to come through for you. I told you I was going to make you a great nation, and I will, just like I said. I'm going to make your name great, just like I said. I'm going to bless you and your descendants, just like I said. I am going to someday make you and your descendants a blessing to the whole world, just like I said. God comes to Abram and he says, Abram, keep trusting me. Keep walking with me. It is going to absolutely be worth it in the end. Abram, friends at Horseheads, First Baptist Church, don't settle for the sad, pathetic rewards of the people around you here. Wait for the reward God has to offer, because that reward is the only reward that's going to satisfy. Now, it's easy for us to look back on this story and realize that Abram ended up making the right choice, right? We know the rest of the story. God keeps his word to Abram, just like he said. And you know what? For Abram, it all turned out okay. But Abram in that moment doesn't see all of how it's going to turn out. Not then, but he saw enough in that moment to keep walking by faith. He saw enough to take the next step. He'd experienced failure down in Egypt. He'd experienced success in this battle against the 9 kings, and he learned the lessons of failure, and he learned the lessons of success. He learned that all success came from God, not himself. He learned that he had to respond with humility, not pride, with gratitude, not selfishness, with generosity, not greed. And he did this because he believed that only God could really reward him and make it worth his while. Only God could give him the life he was meant to live. So as we walk away from this and I send you home, I just have a question for you. How about you? You've experienced some level of success at some point in your life. Have you learned the lessons of success? Or are you still walking around impressed with yourself? Are you still orienting your life around you and your preferences, your desires, your needs? Friends, I'm warning you, I'm begging you, don't let your success set you up for an even greater fall. Turn to God and let him teach you these lessons of success. And step out in faith and keep walking and waiting for his reward. Let's pray. God, this story is so rich, and I'm not sure that I even was able to get at all of it or even a big chunk of it. I hope I was able to capture some of it at least. But Father, we need to remember in the midst of all these things that we're going through, we need to remember that our success doesn't come from ourselves. We don't deserve any of the credit. Life's not about us. It's not about accumulating more for ourselves. It's about you. It's about honoring you. It's about responding in humility and in gratitude and in generosity and trusting and believing that only you are the one that can take care of us and provide us with the life we want to live. Only you can adequately reward us. God, in our good moments and in our bad moments, teach us the lessons we need to learn so that we can walk by faith and not by sight in this world. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.